Mexican is showing. With a squeal, Martina rears back an arm, her hand squeezed into a hard fist, and I hook my hand in her elbow right before she punches the girl in the face. The move is not entirely unselfish. I like to stay out of catfights as a general rule, but seeing as Martina is the one who got me this gig, I'm thinking it's better to stop this one before any blood is spilled. I'm too new to have established a good reputation yet. What reflects badly on Martina reflects badly on me, too. I plant my body between the two women, holding up a hand in both directions. Both of you, see that cross up there? Either shut up or take it outside. Martina opens her mouth to protest, but I beat her to it. This isn't the time or the place. She shuts up. The tall girl, too. They glare over my head at each other while Martina does a deep breathing technique. Less meditation and more trying not to explode. I open my mouth to speak, but it's the Reverend's voice that rings out.
There you are,
he says, and the three of us freeze. Footsteps sound to my left, and I turn to see him walking across the stage. He stops under a stage light, the skin of his forehead shining like wet glass. Particles of dust dance in the air above him, suspended in the beam of light.
Oh, good. I see you've already met Ayana.
Martina tosses me a panicked glance. How much did he hear? But the Reverend's a good 50 feet away, and he has to raise his voice to be heard. He watches us with a benevolent smile.
If you don't mind, I'd like you to work upstairs today in the administrative offices,
he says. And I don't know which one of us he's talking to. I nod, but Martina frowns.
What happened to Oscar?
Oscar is the unofficial head of the cleaning crew, an ancient, gnome-like man who, according to his hunched back and knobby, arthritic fingers, is somewhere between 80 and 150. As far as I can tell, his sole responsibility is pushing a rag over the desks in the administrative offices and shooting the shit with anybody who wanders through. Any other person could do it in half the time, but in this place, seniority comes with the benefit of a cushy job.
Oscar had to go to Florida to visit his ailing mother. He's asked us to keep her in our prayers.
I make a sound of sympathy, even though I'm thinking, Oscar's mother is still alive?
Do you think you could take over just until Oscar returns from his trip?
Of course, Reverend,
Martina says, volunteering in her best Southern Belle accent.
Beth and I will be happy to help.
The Reverend leans back on his heels, his gaze flitting to Ayana, looking at her like she's a child who wasn't chosen for the party.
Maybe you can take Ayana, too. Introduce her around. Show her the ropes.
Martina falls silent, and an angry flush climbs up her neck. I smile up the stage at the Reverend.
Not a problem. We'd be glad to.
Excellent. Well, see y'all upstairs, I guess, and thank you. I'm so happy that God brought the three of you to me. I am blessed beyond measure.
He drops his hands in his pockets and wanders off, leaving the three of us standing in the aisle. As soon as he's gone, Martina swirls to face Ayana.
Swear to God, if you so much as look at me wrong, I'm telling the Reverend what you did.
What did she do? I say, I can't help it. Now I want to know. Ayana folds her arms across her chest, her gaze dipping to Martina's collarbones.
Pretty necklaces. How'd you pay for them?
Martina's face blooms bright purple, two matching spots on each cheek. She sputters something that would make Jesus blush, then turns and stalks up the aisle. I look at Ayana, and she's smiling.
Jeffrey. PDK Workforce Solutions is housed in the center of a shabby strip mall on Sheridan Road, sandwiched between a consignment shop and a serve-yourself yogurt place on the brink of bankruptcy. The parking lot is mostly empty. I'm one of the first ones here, thanks to the early bird reporters who dragged me from a dead sleep, rumbling up in their noisy vans, and calling out greetings like miners punching in at the quarry. So far, they haven't followed me here, though I figure I've only got another day or two before they line up on the sidewalk outside. My boss, Eric, will lose his mind. Inside the glass door, Florence is parked behind the receptionist's desk, slurping from a foam jug of Diet Coke she refills at the donut shop across the lot a couple of times a day. I have no idea what she does here. Up until a few years ago, she was more than happy being a housewife. And then her husband died, and she needed something to keep her busy. She actually used those words on her application. I know, because I've seen it. Eric is such a slouch that he hired her anyway. She sees me, and her eyes go wide. Oh, Jeffrey, you poor, poor dear. I heard about Sabine on the evening news. She rushes around her desk to pull me into a hug. What is the proper amount of time to stand here while a colleague holds you in her wrinkly arms? I count to three, then extricate myself. Thank you, Florence. She smells like cigarettes and oil of Olay. Now so do I. I appreciate your concern.
I just can't believe it. She's really gone? Do the police have any leads at all?
It's the question I tried to ignore all weekend. From the reporters swarming outside my windows. From friends and neighbors who blew up my phone. From my boss who texted me late last night suggesting I take the week off. Every time, the questions hit me like a brick. Are there any leads? I have no fucking idea. The search for Sabine has fizzled. The volunteers have washed the mud off their shoes and returned home to their families and their lives. For police, the investigation has morphed from find her to solve the case, though they're holding developments tight against their Kevlar chests. If there are any leads, if Detective Durand has found so much as a hair from Sabine's head, he's not shared the information with me. I haven't spoken to him since Saturday afternoon, when he stopped by the house to pick up Sabine's computer. Part of me wonders if he's keeping me in the dark because I am a suspect, and the other part already knows the answer. And so I spent the weekend on the couch, monitoring news of the search on my laptop, while a constant stream of Netflix blared on the TV. Most of what I found was a rehashing of old facts or tabloid hacks spinning rumors into conjecture, into motive. That Sabine was taken, that she was killed by a stranger or her lover or me. In a fit of jealous rage, that she made a break for it, sneaked out of town on purpose. That last rumor was the result of my calling Amanda, of parking her on my sofa for an uncensored airing of Sabine's dirty laundry. The reality of last year's disappearing act was only a little less dramatic than I made it sound. Sabine really did board a bus, headed west, I later learned, but she didn't make it very far. Halfway to the Oklahoma border, she received a call from the nursing home that her mother had suffered a fall. She was home before any of us noticed she was gone. But the point is, she intended to leave. She tried to sneak off, and for once without telling her sister. If her mother hadn't tripped over her own 2 feet, who knows how long she would have stayed gone. So now the seed has been planted. Sabine is unstable. She has a history of running off. The husband is innocent. All I can do now is sit back and watch it grow. I sneak a quick glance at my watch. Mandy in the morning starts in less than an hour. I'm starting to think the police are not very competent, I say to Florence, shaking my head. She makes a face, and she swats my bicep with a crepey hand. Well, of course they're not. My house was broken into last year, and they did nothing. They didn't even come by to see the busted-up door or dust for prints. I had to go all the way over to the station just to file a police report. Their excuse was that the gangs on the east side were keeping them too busy for common house thieves. But I was like, well, who the hell do you think did this? Of course it was the gangs. I make a sympathetic sound, even though she's spouting nonsense. The gangs are a problem, yes, but they're slinging dope. Not breaking into old ladies' houses to steal their tchotchkes. But Florence has always been brilliant at this, at flipping any conversation back to her and her own piddling problems. I mumble some excuse about a conference call and head down the hall. The office is quiet for a Monday morning, a few minutes before opening time. No phones ringing, no clacking keyboards, no voices muffled behind cubbies and walls. Eric must not be here yet, otherwise he'd be shouting out orders from his office at the end of the hall. "Make some calls," he'll yell, whenever the office gets too quiet. "Send out some emails!" As if selling his crappy software is as easy as making first contact, but I guess he's right to complain. A silent sales office is not a productive one. I slip into my office and shut the door, going through my normal morning routine. Power up the computer, plow through my email inbox, delete, 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 ignore. A knuckle raps against wood, and a second later, the door pops open. Eric's head pokes around the corner.
"What are you doing here?"
I lean back in my chair, eyeing him over the top of the computer screen. Eric is dressed in his usual gear, pastel button-down, lightly rumpled khakis, suede saddlebucks. He looks like a frat boy playing boss man.
"Working?"
His brows slide into a frown.
"I thought I told you not to come in."
"No, you told me to take however much time I need, but I don't need time. I need to work. That mailing I did last month is finally starting to bear fruit, and I have a million things to do." This place is set up for a roving sales department with company-issued laptops and a VPN that can be accessed from the road. Both of us know I could just as easily work from home as from here. Easier, probably, because I could do it without ever leaving my bed. He glances into the hallway, and I catch a flash of something in his expression. Surprise? Annoyance? Before he looks back at me and steps inside. He shuts the door behind him.
"Jeffrey, people are starting to talk."
"What people?" He makes an "are you kidding me?" face, a minuscule lifting of his shoulders.
"The point is,
who, Eric? What are they saying?"
"I know what they're saying. Sabine cheated. She was in love with another man. Jeffrey Hardison is a fool, a stooge, a sucker."
My desk phone buzzes, and I tap the Do Not Disturb button. The system flips the call through to voicemail.
"People are worried about your wife, Jeffrey," Eric says evenly.
"They're worried about you." His words toss yet another coal onto my belly fire. I slam both fists onto my desk and lean in.
"They're worried? How do you think I feel? Today is day 6. 6 days since Sabine went wherever she went, and there's still no sign of her. The police think..."
I stop myself just in time. I inhale long and slow, trying to put a damper on my tone, on my temper.
"This whole situation is crazy intense. I've barely slept. I've lost my appetite. You can't even imagine the stress I'm under."
"I can imagine, which is why I suggested you take some time off. Nobody expects you to be here, least of all me." I choke up a chuckle, an attempt to laugh it off.
"I gotta tell you, Eric, I never thought I'd hear you tell me I'd done enough work. I thought your motto was, more is more. I barely know what to do with this laid-back version of you."
He doesn't share my joviality, not even a little bit. The silence stretches, long and painful. He leans a shoulder against the door.
"Are you really gonna make me say it?"
I cross my arms, lean back in my chair. "Wait." He sighs, stepping to the edge of my desk.
"Look, if it was just the staff talking, that'd be one thing. But the clients are starting to ask questions, and not just of me. They're talking to each other, and already the gossip is swirling out of control. I can't have potential customers getting wind of this. Business is already bad enough."
I clear my throat.
"So this suggestion of yours for me to take some time off, it wasn't a suggestion, really. More like an order?"
"Both."
"Are you firing me?"
He lifts both hands into the air, frustrated.
"Come on, you know I can't do that. We work in HR, for crap's sake."
There's a knock at the door, which we both ignore.
"I'm placing you on paid leave so you can go home and worry about your wife in private. Just until this thing blows over."
I take a deep breath. Sit here calmly, at my desk across from him, while his words boil under my skin, until this blows over. Meaning what? Until Sabine is found safe and sound, and I'm proven innocent? Or that I'm carted out of here in handcuffs, and he has reasonable grounds to fire me? Which one? There's another knock, this time louder, more forceful. Florence's voice works its way through the wood. Jeffrey, I tried to call, but your phone is on D&D. I roll my eyes, but Eric's gaze doesn't waver. Are we agreed? He says, his voice low and filled with meaning. I give him a brisk nod. Fine. In fact, fuck this place. A paid vacation sounds like just what the doctor... Nope, not going there. Fuck Trevor, and fuck Eric, too. Eric steps back and opens the door, and Florence swipes the air with a knobby fist. She sees him, and her arm falls to her side.
Oh!
Her gaze bounces from Eric to mine.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
My jaw aches from the pressure creeping up my neck and shoulders, from keeping my molars clamped together. Of course she meant to interrupt. Every time she banged on my door, as well as however many times she tried to call. The do not disturb button exists for a reason. It's fine, Florence, Eric says. Jeffrey and I were done. Florence's gaze cuts me like a knife fresh from the freezer.
There's a detective here to see you.
Marcus. Jeffrey's office smells like coffee and expensive cologne, but it can't disguise the stink of his panic when I step through his door. I thank the receptionist and his boss, close the door in their faces. I picture them standing on the other side, pressing their ears to the wood. A detective dropping by an office for an unexpected visit is always a showstopper. They were equal parts captivated and horrified. He watches me sink into one of the chairs across from his desk, trying to read my expression, but I don't give anything away. Let him sweat. I toss my bag and keys on the chair next to me, settling in like I'm planning to stay a while. Thanks for squeezing me in. I'm sure you must be very busy. I take in the PDK poster on the wall, his whiteboard messy with sales numbers and scribbled reminders, the Every Day I'm Hustlin' desk plaque on the edge of his desk. What is it you do here exactly? PDK Workforce Solutions provides an interactive human resources management software that helps grow your business. Recruitment, performance management, workflow, things like that. Honestly, he lowers his voice to a stage whisper, don't buy it. It's a little buggy. I watch him without even a shadow of amusement. Do I need a lawyer? He blurts out before he can stop himself. His nerves are making him restless and blunt. Do you want one? Now I'm amused. A smile sneaks out before I can stop it. That depends on what you're here to ask me. You want to see my list of questions? I point to the pad balanced on a thigh. Not sure you can read my handwriting, though. My wife seems to be about the only one on the planet who can. He doesn't respond, and I drop my hand. How about I just read them off to you one by one and you tell me when I hit the magic button? Whatever remnants of the smile from his mocking of PDK's buggy software disappears. Why don't you just tell me what I can do for you, detective? I flip through the pages of my notebook. As you know, we've been combing through the files on Sabine's laptop, and we found a couple of things I'm hoping you can clear up for us, like her bank accounts, for example. His shoulders drop a good inch in relief. This is a question he thinks he knows the answer to. I assume you're not asking about our joint accounts. I dip my chin in a nod. Correct. Which one? She has three in her name only. The mortgage account, a checking, and a debit MasterCard. Those last two are business accounts, by the way. I don't really have much knowledge of them, other than to help her file her taxes. I'm referring to her savings accounts, actually. The two money markets and the investment account. Jeffrey goes completely still. He gave me Sabine's computer, but not before combing through it. He would have been a fool not to. But these accounts weren't on that Excel file she maintained. They weren't anywhere. I only know of their existence because Ingrid told me. You look surprised, I say, trying not to sound satisfied. His answer comes through gritted teeth. Since when? I consult the papers on my lap. Well, let's see. The money markets are from early January and end of March 2013. The investment account is more recent, December of last year. Together, the accounts add up to a grand total of $379,385.29, give or take. But you know how those investment portfolios go. The value changes faster than you can add up the numbers. He doesn't respond, but I see the thoughts rolling through his mind as clearly as if they were written in the air. Sabine has almost $400,000 squirreled away in accounts she never told him about, in accounts she hid from him for years. I can see you need a minute to process this, so let's come back to it in a little bit. In February of last year, you transferred your share of ownership at 4538 Belmont Drive to your wife, and over the course of the next 16 months, the monthly mortgage payment has been coming from her salary, not yours. He shrugs as nonchalantly as he can. Sabine makes a lot more money than I do. If you've been through the accounts, you know how much more. It only seemed fair. Was this her idea or yours? I don't remember who suggested it, but Sabine was picking up the slack most months anyway. I didn't want it to become an issue between us. Was it ever? Was it ever what? An issue. Because my wife and I, we just throw everything into one pot. But believe me, I get how money can become an issue, because she used to draw a salary. When she stopped working, she felt guilty spending the money in our account since I was the one who put it there. It took me a while to convince her that what's mine is hers, and what's hers is mine. She contributes in other ways, you know. But to each his own, I guess. This is me playing good cop. The witty and let's be buddies cop. Judging from the way his eyes go dark and squinty, Jeffrey doesn't believe it for a second. Sabine and I went in another direction, but believe me, when I say there are no hard feelings between us, I may live in our house rent-free, but I pay the utilities and buy most of the groceries, as I'm sure you've seen on the joint household account. That's my contribution. Sounds like a good deal. Yes, he says, nodding. A good deal for both of us. I scribble some bullshit on the pad, then flip to the next page. Since Sabine's disappearance, you've discovered she was having an affair. That must have been rough. He barks a sarcastic laugh. Rough is one way of putting it, I guess. Finding out about the affair was difficult, yes, it was hurtful. But was it surprising? Maybe not so much. The truth is, Sabine and I have been moving further and further apart for some time now. I'm sure her sister, Ingrid, has told you as much. According to Dr. McAdams, it wasn't just an affair. He says the two are very much in love, that they've been making plans to reorganize their lives so they can be together. By planning to ditch their spouses, you mean? Yes, I know about that too. Ingrid and Dr. McAdams both told me. According to the doctor, Sabine was also pregnant. Yeah, he told me the joyful news. He says it through curled lips and with a tone like he'd just stepped in dog shit. How'd that go over? I punched him, if that's what you're asking, but I'd also caution him, before he gets too excited, to take a look at Sabine's medical records. You think she's lying? I think he should take a look at her medical records. Out of respect for Sabine's privacy, I don't want to say more. You weren't respecting her all that much when you punched her in the face. His face goes white, then beet red, fury firing through his veins. He knows that little tidbit came from Ingrid. It's the same expression he used with her in my office. He stabs a finger on his desk. Okay, first of all, I did not punch her, not even close. It was a light slap with the back of my hand, one I regretted as soon as it happened. That's all it was. That must have been one hell of a slap. We were arguing. Things got heated. She shoved me. I slapped her. Afterward, we apologized, and that was that. We moved on. What were you arguing about? He lifts both hands in the air. I don't know, detective. What does any married couple argue about? Taking out the trash, dirty clothes on the floor, using the last of the shampoo. Take your pick. Would you say you're a jealous man? He narrows his eyes. My wife is cheating on me, Detective. I think I'm allowed to be jealous. But again, I didn't find this out until after she went missing. I shrug. Still, your wife certainly had her secrets. Secret bank accounts, secret lover. I wonder what else she was keeping from you. I leave the question dangling, and he doesn't pick it up. It's something he's probably wondered a million times since finding out about the doctor. But what is it they say? Never ask a question you don't want the answer to. According to Ingrid, Sabine had consulted an attorney, I say, consulting my notepad. She was going to ask you for a divorce, I know. This past weekend, apparently. He leans back in his chair. Ingrid and Trevor told me that, too. I scratch at a cheek, watching him, waiting, for the span of a good 3 breaths, maybe 4. Jeffrey is the first to lose patience. What? I'm just wondering what would happen. If she'd gotten the chance to ask you for a divorce, I mean. Who would get the house? How would you split up your assets? Come on, Detective. We both know I'd get the shitty end of the stick. But okay, I'll play this game. If Sabine and I got a divorce, I'd probably move away. This is a dead-end job in a dead-end town. I'd have better opportunities elsewhere. I nod, satisfied for now. Let's go back to the fight. After Sabine shoved you and you punched her, slapped, he says, his voice clipped. I slapped her, not punched. There's a big difference. After you slapped her, then what did you do? I apologized, of course. So did she. We put it behind us and moved on. But not before you had another heated exchange via text. He pales, his body twitching before he can stop it. What happened? Did she lock herself in a bathroom and refuse to let you in? My wife does that sometimes, drives me up a tree. I can see how that might make you do things you might not otherwise do, say things you might not otherwise say. A smart guy wouldn't have put it in writing, though. I pause, 2 seconds of silence that add weight to my next words, give them extra meaning. Unless, of course, you meant what you said. A smart guy wouldn't have put it in writing, but hey, maybe he's that much of an idiot. I take in his expression, all slack chin and wide, wild eyes, and I'm pretty sure he thinks he's that much of an idiot, too. I flip through my notepad until I find the single sheet of paper I tucked there, and then I slide it out and slap it to the desk. A printout of a text exchange, his and Sabine's. I flip it around so he can see, but he doesn't glance down. He doesn't need to. He already knows what it says. He's the chump who wrote the damn thing. Come out of there or I will fucking kill you. Mr. Harnison, do you own a weapon? Jeffrey owns a .357 Magnum, licensed and registered in his name. If he lies now, I'll have a warrant by the end of the day. He looks sick, like he might actually throw up, and my chest goes tingly and hot. Victory. I think it's time I get an attorney.
Beth. Like the rest of the church, the administrative offices were designed to impress. Solid and thick walls, generous molding, banks of ornate windows hung with gleaming double glass. But they were furnished with the donors in mind. The decor is straight out of an IKEA catalog, functional, minimalist, Scandinavian sleek, as out of place in this neo-Gothic house of worship as a prostitute, which I'm pretty sure Ayana is, or at the very least was. Despite the bucket of cleaning supplies dangling from her finger and the vacuum strapped to her back, her hips wag in invitation, her head swinging back and forth like she's scrounging up clients on Fulton Industrial Boulevard. A hooker, a thief, and a fugitive walk into a church. Except this is a joke without a punchline.
Would you stop? Martina hisses.
Ayana's spine straightens, and she frowns over her shoulder.
Stop what? I'm not doing nothing. The hell you're not! Show some respect for this place. You're not going to find any customers here.
Ayana snorts.
Right, because church people ain't freaks.
Martina rolls her eyes, but she doesn't argue,
And neither do I. With the exception of the Reverend, the people I've met in this place might be freaks. As far as I can tell, he's the only normal one here. The leader of the Land of Misfit Toys. The hallway dead-ends into a spare but bright kitchen, and Martina starts doling out orders.
Every single inch in this place needs to be either dusted, wiped down, or vacuumed. Give extra care to the things people touch most. The telephone, computer mouse, keyboard, drawer pulls, and don't be stingy with the cleaning products. If one person gets the stomach flu, we all get the stomach flu.
She nudges Ayana into an open doorway.
You start in the kitchen.
Ayana tries to strike a contrary hands-on-hips pose, but the vacuum hose gets in the way. She settles for a scowl and a jutted hip.
What are you gonna do? Not that it's any of your business, but Beth and I are going to start in the Reverend's offices. How come y'all get to work together and I have to do everything on my own?
Ayana says it in a way that makes me subtract a couple of years from the age I'd originally guessed. If this girl is legal, it's barely.
Stop bitching and get to work, will you? Martina says. Work your way down the hallway and we'll meet where we meet.
We leave Ayana pouting in the hallway and backtrack to the Reverend's offices at the opposite end, which is a mini-complex unto itself. A private workspace overlooking an English-inspired garden, a conference room with a projection screen and a table that seats 14, a living area with kitchenette and twin three-seater sofas arranged on either side of a low table. The flat-screen television on the wall is tuned to Fox News on mute, bronzed and powdered journalists lined up on a couch in bright ties and floral dresses, their lips moving without sound.
I called dibs on the living room,
Martina says, plunking her bucket onto the coffee table.
Really?
You're not even going to explain.
Explain what?
She leans down to pull a spray bottle from the bucket, and the gold discs swing on their chain around her neck. Bought with Ayana's money, if I'm to believe it. And I just might. I try to make out the letters on the engraving, but the charms won't stop dancing around.
What's up with you and Ayana, of course? You clearly hate each other. Why?
Martina lurches upright, her eyes flashing with anger, with accusation.
I didn't steal her money, okay? I didn't know anything about it, and who tapes money to their toilet tank anyway? Like, isn't that the first place a thief would think to look? If anyone's a thief here, it's her. She just admitted to taking that other hooker's money. You heard that part, right?
I nod. Right, but that's not what...
And excuse me for trying to help a bitch!
She slings an arm through the air.
I mean, who wouldn't feel sorry for a girl her age, out there all on her own? I met her when she was 14. I fed her. I found her a place to stay. I thought I was some kind of mentor to her. Though silly, stupid me, all that time she was taking my money. And she was also taking money from all those men she was spreading her legs for. And never once did she say thanks.
She whirls around and douses a side table with cleaning solution.
Not that I needed a thank you card, but it would have been a hell of a lot better than accusing me of being a thief. Because I'm not. I'm not a thief.
I watch her wipe down the table with sharp, angry strokes and wonder what to say. The thing is, I'm pretty sure Martina is a thief. Ayana never said that the money was taped to the toilet tank. How else would Martina have known that little fact unless she was the one who found it? And what does this mean for our newly formed truce? Was I wrong to believe she wouldn't steal my money, too? A rapping on the doorframe saves me from my thoughts, and the table from Martina's over-eager scrubbing. The man standing in the doorway is a stranger, and yet I know exactly who he is. Same runner's build as the Reverend, same hazel eyes that seem to be smiling even when he's not, same clipped beard, though his is a rusty brown instead of white. He is dressed like his father, too, in jeans and a pressed shirt, but his clothes are more modern, more youthful. Cut in a way that makes me think they might be designer. He even has his father's hair cut, clipped closely on the sides with a longer hank on top, swept off his forehead with an identical cowlick.
What do you want? Martina says,
emphasis on the you. She stands like a statue in the middle of the carpet, the spray bottle and rag hanging from a hand. "Hi," I say, smiling to soften her snub. He takes it as an invitation, moving farther into the room, his cologne mixing with the other smells, bleach, lemon polish, and spicy sandalwood. He extends a hand in my direction.
Erwin Jackson Andrews IV, otherwise known around this place as Erwin IV, the esteemed reverend's firstborn and only son, and last living carrier of the family name. The pressure is enormous.
I laugh and shake his hand. Beth Murphy, and this is...
Martina and I have met many times, haven't we, Martina?
He gives her a good-natured smile. She doesn't return. She doesn't answer either. He turns to me with a shrug.
Have you seen...
Your dad's not here, Martina says. He looks at her, goading.
What if I was about to say Oscar?
Oscar's in Florida, I offer, at the same time Martina asks, were you? Erwin aims his smile at me, then Martina. No, he was not. It's a lighthearted teasing, but Martina isn't having it. She gives him her back, attacking the console on the far wall.
I don't know where the Reverend is. Last I saw him, he was on stage in the church, but that was a half hour ago. He could be anywhere by now.
On the other side of her body, the television flickers a Cialis commercial, an older couple holding hands before a setting sun. Erwin drops his hands in his jeans pockets, and a platinum watch band gleams on his wrist.
If you see him, tell him I fixed his email issue. The last update messed up the syncing between his computer and his phone, but it's working now. I run the IT in this place.
That last sentence he delivers to me, though. I can't decide whether it's meant to inform or impress. His gaze bounces between us, waiting for one of us to respond. He doesn't seem eager to leave. I don't know what to say to this guy, the son of a holy man, the clothes, the watch, the impish half-grin on his face. The result is anything but holy. The silence stretches, long and uncomfortable. Martina ignores us both.
Okay, well,
Erwin takes the hint, backing out of the room.
Nice to meet you, Beth. Martina, you have a nice day. See you all around.
And with that, he saunters back into the hall. What is wrong with you? I say as soon as we're alone. Why were you being so rude to him?
Because Erwin IV is a creep, that's why.
She sprays down the television screen with Windex, and I don't tell her she shouldn't. Something about how the chemicals eat away at the delicate film and distort the pixels. You told me so, right before you backhanded me in the temple for doing it to yours.
He's your boss's son. It wouldn't hurt you to be nice.
She exchanges the Windex for a fresh rag, begins wiping down the screen.
I tried that once. It didn't work out that great. If you know what's good for you, you'll stay far, far away from him. I mean it, Beth. He's bad news.
Whatever she says next fades into a pounding in my head, blood rushing in my ears because a national news alert is flashing across the television on the other side of her body. A face fills the screen, and dread like warm bile bubbles up my throat. I step to the side, bobbing my head to see around Martina's feverish scrubbing. A banner scrawls across the bottom, white text shining on a bright red background. Missing. Sabine Stanfield Hardison. A chill skitters up my spine, hollowing out my stomach and my lungs. I stare at the screen as the photograph grows smaller, shifting to a lopsided square in the upper right-hand corner. A journalist's face takes her place, and I focus on her brows like twin commas squeezed together in concern. Her shiny pink lips are moving, exaggerated, like a silent movie star. I want to search for the remote, but I can't tear my eyes away from the screen. All this time, I've been hunkered down, hiding and watching the news for reports of a missing Pine Bluff woman. And now here it is. And I can't breathe.
The room spins, the words dancing in spots across my vision. Martina steps away from the screen, pausing at the look on my face. She frowns at the TV over her shoulder. What's wrong? Who is that? Her name's Sabine Hardison. My voice is high and wild. It echoes in my ears like a scream. Martina turns to face the television, shifting so we're side by side. She tilts her head and studies the screen. She's so pretty. Do you know her? Do I know her? I try to cough up an answer, but my lungs are hardened concrete. It's all I can do to shake my head. Then why are you looking at her picture like that? My thoughts careen and slide around, searching for purchase, for an acceptable excuse for the silence that I've already let stretch far too long. Like how? Like you want to throw up or something. New words flash across the bottom banner. Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Martina doesn't read them out loud, but she sees them and turns to study me. Her gaze crawls across my profile, over my wide eyes, and cheeks that are burning like I've been in the sun too long. Martina is neither blind nor stupid, and I don't like the way she's looking at me, like she's trying to solve a puzzle. And now my breath is coming too hard, too fast. I need Martina to forget she ever saw Sabine's face, ever saw her name, and those awful words that scrolled across the bottom of the screen. And the only way to do that is to keep moving and stuff my feelings down. I peel myself away from the screen, pick up my bucket, and carry it into the next room, casting one last glance back at the TV. The reporter has moved on to the next subject, and Sabine's picture has been replaced with that of a politician, some old guy with beady eyes and a smarmy smile. Still, just because the image of Sabine's face has been erased from the screen doesn't mean it's not still burned across my vision. I won't forget. And I'm not naive enough to think Martina will either. One false move, one dubious answer, and she'll start up with the questions again. Already her questions are circling the outer rings of a bullseye. It's only a matter of time before she flings one that hits dead center. People don't just fall off the face of the planet. They run, they hide, or they are taken. I should know, because I am one of them.
Marcus. Uncle Marcus! The voice comes from somewhere behind me, a couple octaves higher than the racket of the other 10 people crammed into Ma's tiny brick house. From my niece, Annabelle, the birthday girl. She's the reason for this get-together and why we've all gathered here when normal people are supposed to be working. If Annabelle wants her birthday supper at 3 p.m, Annabelle gets her birthday supper at 3. I scoop her up right before she tackles me at the knees. Happy birthday, Anna Bananabelle. How does it feel to be 8 today? Her eyes go comically big.
I'm 9.
You are. I smack myself on the forehead with a palm. Silly me. Annabelle giggles. My niece may be 9, but she weighs practically nothing. The after effects of a scary bout with leukemia that left my sister traumatized and dropped Annabelle off the bottom of the growth charts. I grab her by the waist, flip her upside down, and carry her by her skinny ankles to the kitchen. We pass my mother on the way, and I drop a kiss on her cheek. Stop flinging her around like that, Ma calls out after us. You're going to pop something out of its socket. I swing Annabelle around in the air and deposit her feet first onto the kitchen linoleum. Her eyes are shining, her cheeks pink with happiness, and maybe the blood rush that comes with being flipped ass over heels. She's smiling with her mouth closed, which is a shame because that hole where her two front teeth used to be is the cutest goddamn thing I've ever seen. Did I pop something out of its socket? She shakes her head, bouncing her pigtails around on either side of her ears. Annabelle's hair used to be brown and straight as a pin. After the chemo, it grew back in spiral curls the color of flaming hot Cheetos. She plants her sneakers and holds up her arms. again. I grab her by the wrists, and she climbs me like a monkey, popping me in the chin as she executes a flailing backflip. I catch her before she can hit the ground and carry her under my arm like a giggling sack of potatoes. She has you wrapped around her little finger. You know that, right? My sister Camille says, watching from the other side of the breakfast bar. She's leaning on the kitchen counter with an ever-present glass of Chardonnay in a hand, another holdover from Annabelle's illness, even though it's the middle of the afternoon. I'm the only one in this family who doesn't treat her like a piece of glass. I put Annabelle down and point her in the direction of the other kids, her two older brothers and their cousins currently tearing up the den. Kids are supposed to roughhouse, Cam. Let her be a kid. Camille makes a sound in the back of her throat, examining me over the rim of her glass. You look tired. I am tired. Fucking exhausted, actually. A week of nonstop work on the Sabine Hardison case will do that to you. I step to the fridge and pull out a beer. That bad, huh? She digs through a drawer for the bottle opener, passes it to me. Still no leads? Nothing I can tell you about. Nothing I can tell anybody about. Like every other person in this town, Camille knows what she's seen on the news, that there has been no trace of Sabine since she walked out the Super One door and disappeared into thin air. No bank transactions, no check-ins on Sabine's Facebook or Instagram, no emails or texts. By now, the media has poked enough holes in Jeffrey's story to turn it to Swiss cheese, turning the tide of public opinion about him from sympathetic husband to primary suspect. And it doesn't help that the guy's an ass. Plenty of people are coming forward with tales of times he ran over their dog or reneged on a handshake deal, and together their stories have swirled into something bigger, something dark and nefarious. And then there's that stunt he pulled with Mandy in the morning. What kind of tool bad talks their missing wife on network television, then starts up an affair with the TV reporter? Neither move won him any points with the stay-at-home mom crowd, women like Camille, blue ribbon, class A gossips, who while away the hours their kids are at school, at coffee shops, and the gym, spreading rumors and stoking speculation. If Jeffrey were smart, which he's not, he'd have kept his paws off Mandy and blubbered into her camera like that lovesick doctor has been doing on other shows, begging for whomever took Sabine to send her back home. Thanks to Trevor's tears and Ingrid's tenacity, the national news caught wind of the story last week. Camille refills her glass with a bottle from the fridge door and drops in two fresh ice cubes. I still think it's the husband. I met him once, ages ago. Some party at the McGillicuddy's, a housewarming or birthday or I don't remember what. But the point is, I walked into the kitchen and there they were, arguing about something. Well, he was arguing. She was mostly crying. Is that so? I pop the top and take a long pull from the bottle. Camille rolls her eyes at my non-answer. As the detective assigned to the case, I'm walking a delicate balance here, releasing enough tidbits to keep the public invested, but not enough to make them lose hope. Feeding them enough information to fuel the investigation, but not enough to trip me up. I'm looking for leads, not vigilantes or armchair detectives. Oh, for God's sake, Marcus. Everybody knows they were on the brink of divorce. Stop acting like I'm revealing some top-secret detail about her life. She was having an affair, and honestly, who wouldn't in her place? Her husband is a real douche. Camille isn't wrong. It's no secret their marriage was on the rocks. My sister is not the only one floating the theory he had a hand in Sabine's disappearance. Nobody's buying his reading a book by the river bullshit, including me. Chasing down what he was really up to the afternoon his wife disappeared has eaten up the bulk of my investigation hours. Fine, you keep your secrets, but at least tell your favorite sister this, you're my only sister. Whatever, just tell me, second favorite brother of mine. A burst of laughter comes from the next room, and she leans her head around the counter to make sure we're still alone. Her concern is not about privacy, but about getting the scoop. Camille hates not being in the know. What are your spidey senses telling you? Do you think you'll ever find Sabine? No. Her eyes go wide. Really? What do you think happened to her? What does your gut say? Honestly, Cam, I drain the beer bottle, chuck it into the recycling bin. My gut says that she's dead. My younger brother, Duke, settles a steaming platter of pot roast swimming on a bed of vegetables onto a table already groaning under the weight of our mother's food. As usual, she's cooked for an army, enough to send all of us home with Ziploc baggies of leftovers that will last us well into next week. I can still hear her banging around in the kitchen, rattling off a one-sided conversation with herself. That needs more dressing. Now where did I put the butter? Don't forget the garlic bread. Ma, come on, I shout. The smells are overpowering. Meat and potatoes and vegetables plucked from the garden out back. You're killing us here. I wink across the table at Annabelle, who sneaked a slice of sausage from the tray and tucked it in a fist. Only Annabelle dares to sneak food because ever since her illness, she's Ma's unofficial favorite, the only one besides me who can get away with breaking the house rules. Rules that for everyone else are ironclad, but for us a little fuzzy. 1. No cussing or talking back. 2. Nobody eats until everyone's seated and the food blessed. 3. Turn off the lights. What do you think, that we own the electricity company? Ma barrels into the dining room in her apron, a frilly floral thing she's had as long as I can remember. Did everybody get themselves something to drink? Nods and yeses all around, including my own, even though my new beer bottle is already empty. Ma would only hold up dinner for me to go get another, and the Durand clan is a ravenous bunch. Best not to get in their way. She sits, then registers the empty place setting at the far end, and her expression shifts from surprised to offended. Her gaze scans the faces at the table, ticking them off one by one in her head. Her 3 adult kids and their spouses, Duke and Joni's twins, Camille and Sean's 2 hellions, and Annabelle. It's only a matter of time before Ma's gaze lands on me. Marcus, where's Emma? My absent wife. Her beloved daughter-in-law. The same person she last Christmas referred to as the daughter she never had. Hello, Mom, Camille had said at the time. I'm standing right here. Ma just patted her hand. You know what I mean. She's been so busy she didn't notice when I walked in without Emma, not until now. I slide the napkin from under my silverware, drape it over my lap. Home in bed, she said to tell you she's sorry to miss this. Like everybody else here, my mother is well aware of my wife's delicate constitution. Emma's always got something, a headache or stomach ache or earache or dizzy spell she can't quite shake. Usually, I'm cool with her bowing out of family dinners and kids' soccer games, but today's different. Nobody misses a Durand birthday celebration, not even Camille, who once waited until everybody was finished with dessert to tell us she was in labor. Was, I say. Emma was sick. She picked up that stomach bug that's going around. What stomach bug? Camille says, looking up and down the table. I haven't heard anything about a stomach bug. Since when? What kind? She frowns at Duke, then at her husband, Sean. Do y'all know anything about a stomach bug? Ma frowns. Well, if she was sick, then why isn't she here? Give her a break, will you? Em's better, but she's still not 100% yet. She just wanted to sleep it off, and honestly, both of us were a little worried she might still be contagious. We didn't want to risk it, not with a house full of kids. I follow up my words with a meaningful glance at Annabelle, whose immune system is still wonky. For Ma, that does the trick. She lets it go, pushing back her chair. I think I have some homemade chicken soup from the freezer. Later, she ignores me, pressing to a stand. I'll just get it out so it can defrost. It'll only take a second. Someone groans, Camille's oldest, I think, down at the kids' end of the table. My mother's freezer is a black hole. Food that gets shoved into its icy belly rarely ever makes it out, except for the one day every year Ma loads everything into shopping bags and takes it to the homeless shelter downtown. If there's chicken soup in there, it'll take her weeks to dig it out. Camille widens her eyes at me, a not-so-subtle sign to stop this train before it runs off the tracks. To her right, the kids clutch their forks and throw wild, panicked glances, all but Annabelle, who's leaning back in her chair and chewing. She looks like a red pigtailed Snoopy, one cheek fat with sausage. Ma! She stops at the door to the kitchen, and I soften my tone. Emma would love some of your chicken soup, but please, for the love of all that's holy, get it later, will you? The kids down here are about to start a riot.
Yeah,
someone whispers. Sean, I think, from the way Camille elbows him in the ribs. Ma looks at the kids, and they bob their heads.
Nana, we're starving,
one of them says. She presses a palm to her bosom, then bustles back over to her chair, reciting a rapid-fire blessing over the food like one of those disclaimers at the end of a radio commercial. Then, finally, come the words we've all been waiting to hear.
All right, y'all, dig in.
There's an explosion of movement and voices, of passing plates and scooping spoons, of people tearing into the heaping platters like they haven't eaten since last week. The Durand version of a food fight, Emma calls it, a complete free-for-all. So much commotion that I almost miss the buzzing at my hip. I see the name, and a shot of adrenaline hits my veins like liquid fire. There were a dozen reasons for me to become a cop. My firstborn's need for order and control, our jailbird father who dropped dead halfway through his 14-year sentence, the way I had to work two jobs to supplement his non-existent life insurance. But this feeling when something breaks, punch drunk with energy and a pulsing in my chest, that's the reason I stay. It's a high as addictive as a pull from a crack pipe. I pull my cell phone from the holder, wave it in the air by my ear, and Ma shoos me off with a flick of her fingers. Some mothers dream of their sons becoming priests. For mine, there is no more honorable profession than cop. In three strides, I'm in the kitchen.
I got something,
Charlie says in that gruff smoker's voice that sounds like he could keel over at any minute. Thank fuck. Charlie is an ex-cop, a freelance detective specialized in finding the unfindable, and my go-to secret weapon. His methods may be a little questionable, according to the chief, a lot questionable, but he's discreet, and he always gets the job done. I pay him under the table and from my own pocket. So far, he's been worth every hard-earned penny. I unlock the sliding glass door and step out onto the tiny deck overlooking Ma's backyard. The late afternoon sun slants through the trees, lighting up Ma's beds of early girl tomatoes and easy-pick beans and whatever the hell else she's got sprouting in the greenhouse at the very back.
I found an application for an apartment in Tulsa, Charlie says. Someplace called...
Papers rustle in the background.
The district at River Bend. I checked it out. More hipsters there than you can beat with a stick, which is exactly what I wanted to do, beat them with a stick. Anyway, the leasing manager conducted a background check that went nowhere. Your gal disappeared before she could sign the lease.
Charlie's message hits me, and I clench my jaw so hard something pops in my temple. My gal knew what she was doing when she filled in that application. She knew that as soon as she forked over her license and social security number and whatever else needed for the background check, they would act as beacons, lighting up her location on a map. An electronic trail leading the police straight to her. It's a bait and switch, I say. She's on the run. Charlie's grunt says he agrees.
I called the number she gave the leasing manager as references. Both took me to Quick Trip. One for the corporate offices in Tulsa, the other for a gas station south of Oklahoma City. That's two places of employment 120 miles away from each other. I thought that was kind of funny. Don't you think that's kind of funny?
Fucking hilarious.
Both of them were dead ends, of course.
Of course. I suck in enough air to pop a lung, then I blow it out long and slow while I count to 10. A ridiculous technique I learned from the department psychologist, and just like when Chief Eubank sent me to the shrink under threat of administrative leave, it doesn't do anything other than piss me off. If she laid a trail to the west, that means she probably went east, I say. She'd stay in the south so her accent wouldn't stick out.
Memphis?
Nah, too close. I'm guessing she'd put at least a day or two's drive between us. Start with the cities.
Got it.
And Charlie?
Yeah.
She'll have dropped some balls by now. I don't know what yet, but find them.
Roger that.
He hangs up, and I slide the phone into my pocket and stand there for a long minute, white-knuckling the railing and watching a bird tug a worm from the dirt. The worm is flailing about, struggling to keep itself tethered to the earth, but the bird claws the ground and holds fast.
Uncle Marcus?
I turn, and there's Annabelle, her pretty face crinkled with worry. Behind her, the sliding door stands open, just enough space for her tiny body to slip through. Hi, Princess. I smile down at her, trying to assess from her expression how long she's been standing there, listening. How much she's heard. She tips her head back, squinting into the sun.
You said a bad word.
I flip back through the phone conversation, trying to remember what I said. Which bad word? It could be one of many. I crouch down, putting us face to face. I did? She nods.
You said f-
Don't you dare. I clap a hand over her mouth. Your mother will string both of us up if she hears you say that. Speaking of your mother, didn't she ever tell you not to eavesdrop on important police business? Annabelle wriggles away from my hand, and she's grinning.
She's the one who told me to come out here and find out what you were talking about.
I laugh, the muscles relaxing in my neck, releasing the tight lines across my back. Is there any food left on the table, or did you savages eat it all? She smiles.
Nana made you a plate, a really big one.
I snatch Annabelle off her feet, swing her around, and carry my squealing niece to the door. Good, because I'm starving.
Beth. I spend the rest of the day obsessing about the missing person report on the TV and thinking about the first time I tried to leave. We'd been married a handful of years by then, long enough for me to know your apologies and promises to change would turn up empty again. But short enough, I still thought I had some sliver of control. In a moment of daring recklessness, I threw some things into a bag, shoved it in the trunk of my car, and drove across town to my sister's house. The week prior, after seeing the bruises across my back and ribs, she'd pressed her house key into my hand and told me to use it any time, day or night. My freedom lasted for all of 4 hours. Just thinking about my sister stirs up a wave of fresh sorrow, a bittersweet churning in my chest. I remember her face when you showed up on her doorstep with flowers and that diamond necklace I still don't know how you paid for. The disappointment that curled on her lips when I followed you out to the car. Do you remember what you said to make me go with you? Do you? Because I remember every single thing. Your hands gripping my arm. Your hot breath in my ear. My sister hollering at me to come back inside. Either get in the motherfucking car, you said, as calm as could be. Or I will slice your sister into a million bloody pieces, and I will make you watch. I got in the motherfucking car. After that, my sister and I didn't speak for months, because I couldn't tell her the truth of what you said, and she couldn't understand why I would go back to someone who kept breaking my bones and my heart. She accused me of being too proud, too blinded by love, and I couldn't tell her that love had nothing to do with it. I went with you that day because I believed you. Unlike all your other promises, that you were sorry, that you would get help, that you'd never ever raise a hand to me like that again. The threat to my sister I knew was not an empty one. You'd slice her to pieces, and you'd do it without blinking an eye. I learned another lesson that day, one that in the end was much more sinister. My leaving was not just about me. You would mow down anyone who got in your way. Hello, Beth? The Reverend's voice comes from right behind me, but it takes two more attempts before I realize he's talking to me. That I'm Beth. I startle, and my head whacks against the upper shelf of the cabinet I'm hunched under. Stars burst across my vision. I slap a hand to the throbbing spot and back out of the cabinet on my knees. The Reverend presses his hands in prayer and gives a little bow. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters. Colossians chapter 3, verse 23. I don't know how to respond to this.
what to say to this godly man who I've put in danger by the simple act of accepting a job. He's one of the people you'd mow down to get to me. Collateral damage, that's what you'd call it. I try to focus on the Reverend's smile, not the spiky ball of dread gathering in my gut. "Can I borrow you for a little bit?" he says. "I could use your help upstairs with the bookshelves in my office." I push to a stand, brushing crumbs and dirt off my pants. "Of course, what's wrong with them?"
"Well, for one thing, the books are just shoved in there, willy-nilly. There's no rhyme or reason to them, and I can never seem to find the one I'm looking for. I need somebody to organize them, come up with some kind of a system. It's a big job, and will probably take you the rest of the day."
I don't understand. Up to now, Martina, Ayana, and I have been a team, scrubbing our way through the church like locusts through a field. And now the Reverend seems to be singling me out. I flick a glance at Martina, frozen on the other side of the daycare room. She frowns, and the look she gives me makes me tense. I wave a casual hand in her direction. "Should I bring some reinforcements?"
"That's an excellent idea, but this room needs to be ready for the kids tonight."
The Reverend turns to them with a smile.
"Why don't you ladies finish up down here, then join Beth when you're done? In the meantime, I'll walk her up and explain what's what."
Martina's brows dip even farther, but I have no choice other than to snag my bucket and follow the Reverend up the stairs, trying to tamp down my heightened sense of paranoia. Why has he called me upstairs alone? Does he know about the fake ID, the fake social security card, the fake everything? Judging from his friendly chatter, he doesn't. We wind our way through the church while the Reverend talks nonstop about his book collection, instructional manuals on expository preaching, a collection of antique Bibles, an entire shelf full of sermons for dummies some jokester puts in his stocking every year at Christmas.
"The problem is, my parishioners are always forgetting to return whatever they borrow. Last year, my wife put those 'From the Library of' stickers inside every book, but it's still a 50-50 shot if I'll ever see it again."
"You could create a sign-out sheet," I suggest as we approach the double doors to the executive offices. "You know, like libraries have. After 2 weeks, their time is up. They have to bring the book back or risk, I don't know, eternal damnation or something." He laughs and opens the door.
"I'm not beyond an infernal threat or two if it means books stop disappearing from my shelf."
Charlene is perched behind the receptionist's desk, a phone pressed to her ear. She smiles as we come inside.
"But the sign-out sheet is a great idea," he says, ushering me down the hall. "Do you think you could make me one?"
I look over to see if he's serious. Why he's asking me, a cleaner, and not his secretary. I study his profile, searching for whatever motivation fueled his question, but I can't find anything beyond a request for help. I tell myself to chill and keep my expression steady and warm. "Sure, I'd just need a computer and a printer."
"You can use mine. My password's Irwin Grace, too."
His kids. He smiles. Obviously proud.
"Just don't tell Irwin Four, or he'll get a big head."
In his office, we spend a few minutes in front of his shelves, floor-to-ceiling slabs of glossy wood stuffed with religious books and icons. The Reverend wasn't joking when he said they were a mess. Bibles mixed in with devotionals and sacred texts and history books and evangelical tomes spread across multiple volumes. There's no order as far as I can tell, no reasoning for the way some shelves are half empty and others crammed to bursting.
"Look at this one," he says, pulling a raggedy book off a middle shelf. "This is the Andrews Family Bible, purchased by my great-great-grandmother and given to her son, Irwin Jackson Andrews I, on his wedding day."
He peels the leather cover open, flipping carefully through the yellowed pages,
to a colorful one at the back, a family tree, the branches reaching out like leafy fingers, ending in handwritten names and dates, births, deaths, marriages. He taps two at the bottom. Erwin's sister Grace and Erwin IV. One day, God willing, they'll pass this down to their kids. They're lucky to have such a beautiful heirloom, I say. This one deserves its own shelf, a middle one, with maybe a spotlight shining on it.
See? I knew I had the right person for the job.
A muffled melody sounds from somewhere deep in his pocket, and he hands me the Bible.
That's my wife. Excuse me a minute, will you?
He ducks into the hallway, and I carry the book to his desk, setting it gingerly next to his computer. I'm not entirely sure I believe in God, but maybe I believe in a greater power, in some sort of order to the chaos. That there might be a reason why the Reverend brought me up here, to a room armed with a computer, and no one to look over my shoulder. Maybe this is the universe laying out the pieces I need to survive, fate pointing me the way. All day long, I've been smuggling snippets of time in the bathroom, scrolling through news on the tiny screen of my phone, fretting about how the searches are eating up expensive data I can't afford. And now here I stand, next to a computer I know the password to. The sneakier part of my brain kicks into gear, and my whole body tingles. Or then again, maybe this is a test. Maybe the Reverend suspects me of violating his trust, and this is a chance to prove to him I'm worthy. The Reverend's voice is gone now, faded down the hall. I check my watch. Think of Martina and Ayana downstairs, wiping germs off a million plastic toys. They'll be busy for another hour or more. But how long do I have before the Reverend wraps up his call? Seconds, maybe.